From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why Comedy Central's South Park has pretty much vanished in China. Then the movie Parasite may have won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, but when I visited with director Bong Joon-ho at the Telluride Film Fest, he was telling moviegoers in line it was no big deal.
I'm shouting to the people, and movie is very boring, so please don't waste your time.
And Nellie Mackay brings her quirky music to the stage in a new work from filmmaker Ethan Coen. All that coming up on The Frame. Comedy Central's South Park is no stranger to controversy. Over the show's almost 300 episodes, creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone have taken on everything from Scientology to the war in Iraq. Now the show has a new critic, China. The latest South Park episode, titled Banned in China, takes on, among other things, how Hollywood panders to the massive Chinese entertainment market. Here's a cut from the episode that gets right to the point.
I can't do it anymore, you guys. I can't even think with the Chinese government censoring everything I write.
So there's not going to be a biopic movie for us?
It's so wrong, you know? I mean, we live in a time where the only movies that us American kids go see are ones that are approved by China. Yeah, it's like China is the new MPAA.
Ryan Parker wrote about the controversy for The Hollywood Reporter, and he tells me how the Chinese government has reacted so far.
Well, from everything that we can see from our correspondent, it looks like South Park has been pretty much banned in the country, and all references to South Park have been scrubbed from any online sites. Basically, from everything we know, if you search for South Park, you're not going to get any information, and apparently all the streaming services have also ceased carrying any of the episodes and any of the clips, so it's almost as though South Park all of a sudden doesn't exist.
I want to play a little cut from the episode here. This is a scene which may have caught the eye of some Chinese censors. In this bit, a very angry Mickey Mouse, who might also be Disney head Bob Iger, is chastising a room full of Disney and Marvel characters.
Which one of you decided to go and start bad-mouthing the Chinese government? Who here thought they had permission to say anything critical of Chinese politics?
Well, it is true, sir. The Chinese seem to exploit their own people with forced labor.
Shut the f*** up, Thor! You're here to flex and not think!
So, I would say there's a fair amount in the Banned in China episode that Chinese censors could be a little bit angry about. If you were to kind of pick a couple of examples, what would you cite?
Well, I think that the Winnie the Pooh reference definitely did not go over well. I think that's been well reported that that's a huge issue there. And then the way in which the work camps were portrayed were in the abhorrent conditions that those in prison there had to go through, and was also probably did not go over well.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh, I think, in some circles, has been compared to the appearance of President Xi. And Winnie the Pooh essentially vanished from a lot of social media sites in China. Is that right?
That sure seems to be the case from everything that I've seen reported. And that apparently is what Matt and Trey, the creators of South Park, thought too. And that's one of the reasons why Randy, when he gets put into a work camp, runs into Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, and they explain exactly what's happening in the news, which is far from the first time that Matt and Trey have used South Park and real-world events and news and worked it into the storyline. So, you know, they're getting their laughs, but they're also teaching a few things that maybe some folks aren't aware of.
Listen, guys, we just got word back from the Chinese censors. They don't want us mentioning organ transplants.
How come?
Well, they've been accused of harvesting organs from the... Look, it doesn't matter. They just said no to the organ stuff. Oh, and no homosexuality either.
There's this great phrase in the law. It's a Latin phrase called re ipso loquitur, which means the facts speak for themselves. And I have to say, the fact that Chinese censors are blocking South Park pretty much validates the whole point of the episode, doesn't it?
It would sure appear to be that way. I think that Matt and Trey were definitely making a point, or numerous points, rather, when they did this episode, both about how Hollywood and some studios tailor their art to fit the Chinese censor so that they can obviously make money there, but also the abhorrent conditions that the work camps in China, or what people who are in those work camps in China, the abhorrent conditions that they have to go through.
So there have been a couple run-ins with China recently. One is the MBA, and the MBA has apologized because of what it called an inappropriate comment by the general manager of the Houston Rockets, who sent out a tweet in support of Hong Kong's democracy movement. Matt and Trey have come out with a slightly different statement. What did they say in response to the controversy?
Well, they went right for it, which they usually tend to do, lean in, and they said, like, quote, like the NBA, we welcome the Chinese censors into our homes and into our hearts, in part. And basically what they were saying in this full apology is that money is more important than freedom and democracy. So they definitely were leaning in and taking a shot with this faux apology, and I can't imagine this will be the last we hear of it. I wouldn't be surprised if there was something in this week's episode. I don't know necessarily, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if this is the last we hear of it from them.
And South Park obviously has not shied away from controversy in the past. Does this feel like it's part of the show's ethos that they're always going after people that they think need to be criticized?
I don't know if I'd specifically say it like that, like they're going out of their way to do it. I think that Matt and Trey are hyper aware of numerous issues that are going on in the news and in the world, and they use their show as a way to address something that's on their mind. I don't think that they plan necessarily on these storylines becoming such huge news. I can't imagine that they sat around thinking, oh, this one story will make huge headlines. They did it because clearly something about it bothered them, and because they did it and it rang true, or however it rang to people, it's become a huge talking point now. But I can't imagine that they sat around wanting to do this story just to make the news.
Yeah, but they did succeed, and it is incredibly topical, and I think we also have to acknowledge that it's also darkly funny. Ryan Parker is a senior staff writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up next on The Frame, South Korean director Bong Joon-ho blends horror, comedy, and sci-fi into a terrifying film about class called Parasite. Parasite is a dark but often funny Korean drama about two families, one rich, one poor, and the very bad things that happen when they come together. The movie was co-written and directed by Bong Joon-ho. He also made Snowpiercer and Okja. I spoke with the filmmaker outdoors at the Telluride Film Festival, where moviegoers were lining up for the North American premiere of Parasite. Bong Joon-ho was with his translator, Sharon Choi, and as we watched people enter the theater, I was curious if he ever goes to see his films with the general public.
So I actually did go to a theater in Korea once. I wore a hat and I was very sneaky about it. And I watched the film amongst the audience, and it was a very fun experience. I got to see their responses immediately, and I felt a sense of pleasure from it. And I also felt this compulsion to almost spoil the story for the audience sitting next to me as well.
I want to ask you about Parasite, because my understanding is you originally wrote it for theater and not for film. Is that right?
So it wasn't as if I wrote the script for a theater production, per se. I originally came up with the idea, toying with how it would be to put two houses on stage, and that was how the idea began. But I quickly realized that film is the right medium for me. And so from the very first beginning, I wrote the script for the screen.
So when you say two houses on top of each other, kind of upstairs, downstairs, does that mean the idea for this movie comes to you visually first, that maybe the rich family is up here and the poor family is down there, and then you fill in the story? Do you see it first before you start to write it?
이미 시나리오 쓸 때 공간들의 구조에 대해서 많이 설계를 했어요.
So because I'm a writer and director, even from the script writing stage, I already had all the structures of the spaces in mind. They were already pre-designed as I was writing the script. And for Snowpiercer, the class was divided with the tail cars and the front cars. And with this film, I wanted to align different classes vertically.
I'll just jump in here. In his 2013 film Snowpiercer, Bong Joon-ho created this dystopia on a train where the haves and the have-nots are clearly separated by the front and back of the train. And at one point, a character played by Tilda Swinton visits the unruly class in the back and lays down the law.
Order is the barrier that holds back the frozen death. We must, all of us, on this train of life, remain in our allotted station. We must each of us occupy our preordained particular position.
In Parasite, the divisions are defined not by train cars, but by real estate, how nice your home is, and in Korea, whether or not your place has a basement.
특히 한국은 좀 지하실이 미국 가정보다 지하실이 좀 더 드문 편인데.
In Korea, compared to homes in the States, basements are very rare, and I think basements provide a lot of layers that you can't quite always predict. I think when poor people look at rich people, you always get a sense that we don't know everything about the rich. For poor families, everything seems to be exposed, but there's this lack of information that you feel regarding rich people. You always feel like there's secrets and layers to them that we can never discover.
When you have an idea in your mind of what the places they're living in look like, and then you go to find those places, it can sometimes be difficult. The house that a lot of this story unfolds in is an amazing piece of architecture, and it's also separated from the rest of the world just by a door, that there is this kind of rich person's utopia on one side and the ordinary world right behind it. How important was it for you to find the right house? Because the house is almost its own character in this movie.
집이 정말 중요한 캐릭터고 뭐 특히 부잣집이 영화의 한 60%.
As you said, the houses are very important characters in the film, in particular the rich house. Most 60% of the story happens in that house. So we actually built the houses. We knew from the beginning that it would be impossible to find the locations. So with the production designer, we built the houses on set.
Even the whole neighborhood, the poor town, is all rebuilt. And also, 문하고 그 문과 계단?
And also doors and staircases are very important elements in the film. The sort of new world and new layer that opens up when you open a door and the meaning behind going up and down the stairs, it's very significant for this film. And so we discussed a lot about doors and stairs with the production designer and the cinematographer.
We're talking with director Bong Joon-ho about his new film Parasite, outdoors at the Telluride Film Festival. The poor family in Parasite are pretending to be people they're not. And part of the joke is they're better at doing those things than maybe the people this rich family would hire in terms of tutoring, in terms of driving. They're better than the people they would have ordinarily brought into their lives. They're totally qualified.
예리한 지적이에요. 그들이 사실 사지가 멀쩡해요.
That's a very sharp point because they're actually very properly normal and capable people. They're smart and they're capable, but despite that, they still don't have jobs. And I think that's the sad part about economic inequality all over the world these days. It's not that they're dumb and stupid that they don't have jobs.
And yet the Kims, the poor family, understand the rich family in ways that maybe the rich family doesn't even understand themselves. They have a way to assimilate and ingratiate themselves with that family that doesn't really work in the reverse direction, right? That they understand what privilege means and how to operate in that world, even though they have no experience in it.
아주 흥미로운 질문이고 내가 듣고 싶었던 얘기기도 한데.
That's a very fascinating question, and it's a question that I wanted to hear. I think for the rich family, it's not that they can't understand. It's more that they just don't really want to know. The line about not crossing the line, it's about someone not liking someone intruding that line, but it's also about not wanting to look out beyond that line as well. All they want to see is their comfortable environment.
그 영화의 클라이막스 시퀀스에서도 아마 그걸 느낄 수 있을 거예요. 되게 빠르고 정신없게 펼쳐지는 시퀀스지만
And you really get a sense of that in the film's climax. It happens very fast and hectic, but you really see them operating within the lines that they arbitrarily draw for themselves. Even if something is like one inch beyond that line, they treat it as something that belongs to another universe, another world. And I think that's very intimately tied to the theme of this film.
When I think about Parasite, I think about The Host, I think about Snowpiercer, I think about Okja. There are so many fantastical elements to all of those films, and they're difficult to categorize, and yet they all seem to be about real-world issues. They can be about consumption, they can be about class struggle, they can be about families. Do you find, as a storyteller, that sometimes the more extreme a story becomes, the more real it can play?
내가 정치적인 영화를 만들어야 된다, 또는 무슨...
So it's not as if I intend to make a particularly political film with propaganda. My effort is always to delve into the really mundane, small, daily issues that surround me. But once I delve into those issues, I find myself ending up in a dark cave of capitalism. And so it doesn't happen because I wanted to, but I just end up dealing with those issues.
My goal is always making funny movie.
Your film Snowpiercer was a critical success in China and abroad, but Parasite was recently removed from China's first film festival because of technical reasons. How do you think about how your film, and this film in particular, are received in different countries, even countries they may not welcome it?
중국은 항상 예측하기 힘들어서 또 그런 재미가 있는 것 같아요. 근데
China is always very difficult to predict, but we do have a Chinese distributor who acquired the film, and I think that they must have done it because they have certainty that it will be released in theaters, but you can never predict the government or the Communist Party's decisions for China, but I do hope that one day it can meet Chinese audiences.
Parasite became the first Korean film to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. What does that mean to the film? What does that mean to you, and what does that mean to Korean cinema?
모르겠어요. 한국 영화가 마침 또 100주년이었어요. 금년에. 그래갖고 century 뭐랄까 뭐.
So this year marks the 100th anniversary of Korean cinema, and a lot of people discuss this award as a historical gift to celebrate it. And I think it was an incredibly coincidental, amazing gift. But I do think that Korea should have received this award earlier. There have been a lot of amazing Korean film directors, like Kim Gi-young, who directed The Housemaid. And I think relatively compared to Japan and China, Korean films were spread to the Western world a little bit late. And of course, personally, I consider this award a huge honor, but I try my best to work so that before and after this award, things really haven't changed as much. Even before this award, I was working on 2-3 projects, and I'm trying to calmly continue on with those projects.
Sharon Choi and Bong Joon-ho, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you.
And you can see Parasite in theaters starting this Friday, October 11th.
I guess I'll have to change my plan.
Up next on The Frame, the real star of Ethan Coen's new play might not be an actor on stage. It could be a musician who wanders the theater during set changes. Musician and singer Nellie Mackay has never been married to a single format. She stopped by the studio to talk about her upcoming 8th album titled The Bagatelles and her role in Ethan Coen's A Play is a Poem. In Coen's collection of short plays, Mackay performs original songs between each section.
I think Ethan just wanted to cover the set changes, and I guess we have. But I think with Ethan and Neil, they both wanted the songs more to set up the oncoming act, whereas I was always kind of reflecting on the previous one. So it's a little how people prefer to sit on trains, you know, facing forward or backwards. I'm always fine facing backwards, but...
And Neil is the director, Neil Pepe. So what does that mean? Because the stories are set in different time periods and they have different thematic ideas. Some are, let's just say, a little bit violent. Some are more about kind of family squabbles, and some are a little bit more comedic. Does that suggest a tune? Does that suggest a lyric? What does that mean to you when you start thinking about what the right music is?
The juxtaposition, especially in film, between what's going on and what the music is, it just has to work somehow. But there's no necessary rhyme or reason to it why it works. So I think sometimes the contrast helps, and sometimes there's somewhat of a commentary on what's come before. I guess it's up to the audience to draw their own conclusions.
I saw the show on opening night, and you were playing a song, and you made a reference to John Goodman, who, I don't know if you'd seen him, but he was in the house about 25 feet from where you were singing. You made some crack about how he might be a member of the deep state. How much of the song is improvised, or is it pretty structured? How much freedom do you have to kind of make things up as you go along?
There are a couple of points, but it just has to stay under time. That's the main thing. And I had been tipped that he was there, but I didn't know he was sitting so close.
He was.
But he is deep state.
He was literally, if you'd taken 10 more strides,
yeah,
you would have come across him. And who knows what would have happened. So when you're playing, there are set changes going on. And you probably have to be mindful of how long those set changes are going to take, because I assume that means sometimes the songs can run a minute, sometimes 45 seconds, sometimes a minute and a half. How do you know when they're ready for you to stop?
You kind of hear things. There's one light I have to look for, and it's way above my head. I try to do it subtly.
Which is basically a flashing red wrap-it-up light, something like that?
That's what I said. I thought maybe a light like at a comedy club, but it's subtler than that. But I'm not. I have the acting chops of Peter Lawford, so.
We're talking with Nellie Mackay about the play called A Play is a Poem at the Mark Taper Forum, and about her new album called The Bagatelles. So you brought your ukulele along.
Yes.
Tell us what you'd like to play.
Well, I'd like to play a song from the show.
For the people listening, imagine on stage they're changing some scenery, but you're not watching that. You're watching Nellie play the song.
I met him at a protest, dolled up in his finest finery, a Malcolm X t-shirt and a tambourine. To love him it was hopeless, the cannons fairly shook the barricade. We came in at the chorus, I could hear him say, eating that burger past a kitchen, the condiments eating that mother. Don't that a hot sauce hit the spot, eating that torture. Won't you let your conscience warm you? I for that mother you can't see suffer. And one for all and all for another. A long October under the sun. Change comes for the better. If you want it, our change will come. Hey, you eating that burger? Are you all Americans eating that mother? Give the chef my compliments, eating that torture. Won't you let your conscience warm you? I for that mother you can't see suffer.
I mean, I love that song, and it's almost as visual a song as what we're seeing on stage. You can actually picture this scene that you're describing. Do you write that way? Do you have an image of the characters in your song? What comes first? Because it's so vivid in terms of the visual cues you're giving the audience.
Gee, I don't know. You know, we went to Jamaica to record it, and we had some time there. I have no idea. Maybe it was a little bit it was influenced by the scene down there. You know, when Dylan wrote, I believe, Desire, that Hurricane was on his album, and, you know, he was working with the screenwriter, Jacques Levy? But Hurricane begins with pistol shots running out in a barroom night. You know, it's so visual right from the get-go. I think that's wonderful if you can.
Nelly, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your music with us.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
As we go out, Nelly, why don't you play a little bit of your recording of The Best Things in Life Are Free?
Oh, lovely.
The moon belongs to everyone. The best things in life are free.
Nelly Mackay is in Ethan Coen's A Play is a Poem at the Mark Taper through October 13th. Her album, The Bagatelles, is out on October 25th. And that is it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.
The sunbeams that shine.